Coaches can convey a moral stance, one that is not rigid, punitive, or unyielding, but rather derives from establishing a loving sense of connection with the boys and acting as an important adult role model. As one boy told me about his soccer coach, his golden rule is don't ever tell anybody what they can or can't do. Just smile and show them what you can do. Nobody's perfect, and the only thing you can really control is your own game. Our coach is always real nice and friendly, sort of like a camp counselor or something. He tells us that if you do good, other people will be inspired, and then they'll do good too. What's great about Mr. Schroeder, said another boy about the same coach, is that when we win a match, he takes us out for donuts, and we celebrate. And when we lose a match, we still go out for donuts. We're just a little less rowdy. As the boys' mentor, the coach is in many respects a stand-in for mother and father. Even a boy with two very loving parents may find his afternoons filled with the voice of his coach rather than the voices of his parents. Especially for the adolescent boy who may find himself somewhat distanced or detached from his parents at times, the coach may be one of the few adults to whom he will look for guidance, support, and encouragement. Mr. Jensen helped me through some hard times, offered 17-year-old Glenn about his basketball coach. I had to go through a bunch of surgeries to correct my eyesight. I had a lot of problems seeing, and kids made fun of me because one of my eyes looked funny. Coach Jensen told the other kids that anybody that made fun of me would be kicked off the team, and that a lot of pro players had eye problems, too. He let me play in a lot of games and didn't yell at me when I fouled. Everybody loves Mr. Jensen. He's just a great guy. A coach has a unique opportunity to help boys feel good about themselves. By setting up sports in such a way that boys can achieve personal mastery, by staying away from shaming words, and by inspiring all boys, no matter what their relative skill levels, to feel they can develop athletic skills and contribute to the team, coaches help boys to avoid seeing sports as a cult of competition or narcissistic aggrandizement, and instead make sports a place for personal growth. Coaches who teach shame. But regrettably, not all coaches have a positive, nurturing attitude, and many have limited interest in structuring sports creatively to embrace boys' varying degrees of skill. Far from helping and reassuring the boys they mentor, some coaches instead resort to shame, exhorting boys to play with your pain, get your butt going, and not act like a girl. 18-year-old Michael D'Amico recalled one such traumatizing lacrosse coach. He acted like an army officer or something, a total drill sergeant. He would shout out your last name and then just tell you off, like, D'Amico, you're doing push-ups like a little sissy. Now get your ass in gear. Or, D'Amico, what the hell are you doing? Can't you see the damn goal? Which side are you playing for, anyway? A coach who manipulates his players to win at any cost, or models unrestrained anger, communicates the soul-denying harshness of sheer competition, where the essential element of play within sports has been removed, and with it much of the chance for personal growth. Parents need to know their sons' coaches and to make sure they are men or women who see sports as play, who project the kind of warmth and understanding that enables boys to cope with winning and losing, and who encourage boys, no matter what their relative skill level. Just as parents should not put up with teachers who shame their sons, parents should be sure their sons are mentored in sports by nurturing, empathic people. When the boy code comes back into force, the return of shame and hardening. Yet even in the presence of a thoughtful coach, boys can become prone to following the old boy code rules that equate masculinity and being a man with athletic competence and success. These rules lead some boys who do well athletically to humiliate, even condemn, boys who do less well. I believe these boy code rules come back into force most often when boys are prodded into believing that performing well or winning, rather than playing for the fun of it, is the be-all and end-all of the game. When playing sports becomes about winning at any cost, and about humiliating anyone who loses or who contributes to your own loss, boys feel pressured not only to put on their emotional armor and act tough, but to tease or rebuke other boys for showing any weakness or vulnerability. Thus, as much as sports can create a positive space where boys are comfortable expressing their feelings, show their affection more freely, develop enhanced senses of self-esteem, and learn together about loss in a constructive way, the transformative experience of sports, they can also thrust boys into a universe of shame and humiliation, where they come to feel very anxious about doing well, yet know their feelings must be buried even deeper. Just about any parent who has sat through a high school baseball game has heard the cries of, "He's no batter, he's no batter," resounding throughout the ball field, and has watched the teenage batter, instead of blushing, succumbing to tears, shouting back, or just giving up entirely, actually tighten up his face, concentrate intently on the oncoming pitches, and apparently ignore the humiliating epithets flying about him. And many parents have had to deal with a son who, less talented than some of his peers, has been put through the humiliation of being consistently picked last for gym class teams, or perhaps regularly taunted as being a wimp, a loser, when he's attempted in vain to succeed at a particular sport. While some of these boys may try to avoid athletic activities altogether, others harden themselves against the pain of being persistently rejected and disgraced. Tommy, the lessons start young. The first time I observed Tommy, he seemed rather lost on the large white ice skating rink. I was taking my daughter to her skating lesson, and I noticed one of a very few 5-year-old boys taking lessons among a majority of girls. Dressed in his miniature hockey uniform, Tommy looked as if this was the last place on earth he wanted to be. Still, encouraged by the comments of his father on the sidelines, Tommy valiantly struggled to stay up on those skates, but his wobbly legs kept betraying him. After his fourth spill, this one drawing blood from his already battered knees, Tommy sought his father's solace near the visitors' gallery. "No more today, Dad," Tommy pleaded. "My knee really hurts." "Nah, that doesn't hurt too much," his dad replied. "Come on, keep going. You're not going to let a bunch of girls beat you out of the competition, are you?" The shame on Tom's face was painful to see. He didn't want the whole world to think he was a wimp, less strong than even the girls. He barely held back his tears and slid away from his dad, back onto the ice. And then there was a loud crash. Before he could steady himself, Tommy was smashed by 2 teenage girls who collided with him simultaneously from opposite sides. Tommy fell to the ice, crushed both emotionally and physically. Tommy's father helped him up and asked, "Are you okay, kid?" The beleaguered little boy, looking like Muhammad Ali after too many rounds of too many fights, stammered, "I guess so." "You're okay, you're fine," his father said. "Don't give up. I know just what will help. Keep skating. It will loosen you up." The little boy obediently turned around and continued skating falling, skating, falling. About a year later, I arrived at the rink when I noticed that a group of about 20 boys were scrimmaging in preparation for an upcoming hockey game. Donning a bright red helmet and matching uniform fitted over pads clearly too big for his frame, there was 3-foot Tommy DeSantis skating with the other boys and chasing after the puck. Within just minutes of observing the practice session, I saw an inevitable repeat play of what I had seen many months ago. As Tommy maneuvered the puck toward the opposing team's goal, 3 much larger boys rammed into him from all angles. When Tommy began to lose his balance, one of the boys helped him finish the fall, shoving little Tommy onto the ice. If just months ago this might have left him immobilized and in tears, today Tommy got right back onto his feet, adjusted his helmet, and skated off after the boys. His skating now significantly improved. Tommy raced after the opponents with abandon. As he approached the kid who had pushed him, Tommy skated even faster. When their 2 bodies collided almost head-on, his opponent went flying against the sideboard with a forceful bang. "That a boy!" I heard a man shout from the bleachers just a few feet behind me. Mr. DeSantis stood up, let out a loud whoop, and threw his 2 fists up into the air to salute his son. As if he couldn't hear his father, Tommy kept his eyes squarely on the ice and skated off behind his teammates. I've told the story of Tommy to many parent groups, and I've learned a lot from the reactions it receives. Some people don't see anything wrong with Tommy's experience or his dad's conduct. Tommy, they believe, will have to learn to play rough with the big boys. They see sports as a component, even as a positive component, in helping their sons learn how to act tough and endure pain silently. Be fierce, quiet, and resilient, act masculine in the stereotypical sense of the term. They fear what it would mean if their sons were not willing to submit to this toughening process, dreading the humiliation that would follow for them and their sons. While they may not like the sight of Tommy crashing onto the ice, or the sound of his coach, in this case his father, spurring him on to be tough and retaliate against the other boys, many parents see these things as somehow necessary, part of growing up, of being a boy. Other parents are far less comfortable with the hardening aspect of sports. They see Tommy as being taught an unattractive kind of ruthlessness, as being pushed to act in a way that does not actually come naturally to him. They see Tommy's father's behavior as abhorrent. Why, they ask, would a father encourage his child to put up with being hurt and cheer him on when he injures others? As one mother said, "I'm proud of my son when he does well at a sport, but being proud doesn't feel worth it if he's going to have to go through all of the cruelty that goes with it." Or as another parent exclaimed, "I can understand what the boys sometimes do to each other, but the parents... I can't stand those parents shouting out the meanest, competitive things from the sidelines. Don't they realize they're hurting and embarrassing our kids?" I have found that the majority of parents feel torn between wanting their boys to excel athletically, to be prepared for the rough aspect of sports, and do whatever is necessary to be counted among the team, and wanting to protect their sons from the unnecessarily mean-spirited, cutthroat, emotionally sterile aspects of so many boys' sporting activities. Many parents appear to regret the ways in which sports toughen up their boys emotionally, and often wish that sports could be a more positive, uplifting, and confidence-building experience for their sons. As one father expressed to me, "When my son Keith was the last guy to strike out, I could see how bad he felt. The other boys were hardly talking to him, and the coach wouldn't even look at him, let alone say something to him. Keith was trying to act relaxed about it, but I could see he was miserable. I wished I could go up to him and tell him that he was a good kid, and that he actually played very well, that the pitcher on the other side just happened to be pretty damn good. But I thought that maybe that would make him feel worse. I felt like I just wanted to go up to him and give him a big hug, but I knew he would be really embarrassed if I did that. Like Keith's father, many parents worry that if they step in and say or do something, they will only exacerbate their son's feelings of shame. But it is here that, in my view, so many parents miss out on an opportunity to help change things for the better. For as natural as it is not to want to rock the boat or make things worse, I believe that parents can make an enormous difference in what sports are about, without further humiliating their sons, by staying persistently involved in monitoring and overseeing what kinds of attitudes prevail on the court and in the field. In fact, I've known groups of parents who have attended referee schools, coaching workshops, and conflict resolution seminars, and then woven together these skills into a manual that teaches a new approach to coaching boys' teams. If their involvement is regular and inconspicuous, and if healthy attitudes come to pervade the game, parents can have a tremendously positive impact on how a sport is played and experienced, helping to decrease the shame ante for the whole team, and to make sports transformational as we've seen they can be. The unnecessary brutality of sports. In addition to pushing boys to taunt and reprimand one another for their mistakes and weaknesses as athletes, society's rules about masculine behavior also sanction the sheer brutality that can sometimes creep into so many of boys' games. While some sports, such as crew, tennis, golf, do not involve such brutality, many others, football, hockey, wrestling, are surprisingly ruthless. Even soccer, normally seen as a relatively easy, fluid game, less violent and more forgiving of weakness than sports like football or rugby, can, in the wrong hands, become terribly violent. Listen, for instance, to 17-year-old James, the 6-foot-145-pound designated enforcer of his high school soccer team. Before, if someone did something to you, for the good of the team, you wouldn't retaliate. Now, if somebody gets you, you're going to get them for the pride of the team. If I got hit, and one of the younger kids on my team saw me just back down and not retaliate, that would spread through the whole team. It would be like, you're not a man. James remembers how he almost started a fist fight with a superior player. We both went up for a head ball, and he nudged me in the back. I fell down pretty hard, and that triggered something in me, so I swung around, my whole body, and I got up in his face, and he said, "What the F are you going to do?" And I said, "What the F are you going to do?" And we started bumping. James added, "It used to be the old saying that it doesn't matter whether you win or lose. I don't think anybody lives like that anymore." The obsessive competitive aspect of sports. If cultural imperatives allow our sons to experience sports as an opportunity to exchange anger and act out hostile or violent feelings, sports can sometimes also become an arena where boys are pushed to become compulsive about doing well, making themselves strong, or beating the competition. This compulsive aspect of sports can lead boys to train themselves in an excessive way, mask or ignore serious injuries, or become overly zealous in how they play a particular sport. Peter, obsessed with athletic success. Peter Vincent, a senior at a highly competitive public high school, describes himself as someone who was conceived with a purpose. His parents' marriage was failing, and they hoped a new baby would reconnect them somehow. Their first two children were already 10 and 14, and perhaps a little one's pressing needs and endearing quality would help bridge the widening gap between the parents. But the fact that Peter was a boy, he says, added a gender-specific tone to those expectations. I felt the pressure to be a hero to my mother and father, even my brother and sister, from the earliest time I can remember. They wanted an academic genius and a standout athlete, and I've always tried with all my might to give them what they wanted. After earning MVP awards for both football and baseball last year, Peter was forced to drop out of the football team this year after just 2 games. I had hurt my knee during our first game, but I didn't want to say anything to my mother or my coach. Yeah, it hurt during the warm-up before the second game, but I just hoped it would go away. I had to keep playing and winning to be the MVP again this year. Midway through the first half, Peter re-injured the same knee and had to be carried off the field. It will be a few months before the cast comes off. I haven't looked my mother in the eye since it happened, Peter says. How could I have done this to her? I ruined her life. My older brother and sister are on the other side of the country. My father's been gone for years, and my mom's never been out on a date or anything since then. The only thing she had to look forward to this fall was my football season. My father came to see me in the hospital, but he hasn't come to see me since. He says he's busy at work, but I know he wanted me to get 2 MVPs again this year, or at least 2 letters like he did in his senior year. Sometimes I have images in my mind of jumping in a deep pool so my cast will make me drown, Peter admits. Then I wouldn't have to let my parents down ever again, and I wouldn't have to worry about what college I'm going to get into either. As Peter's story shows, boys can be overwhelmed with a feeling that they must do well at sports, that if they don't maintain a certain level of accomplishment somehow, they'll suffer an intolerable loss. Peter, of course, had already had many losses in his life. The disabling injury, his parents' divorce, the remote relationship with his father, the sense he wasn't loved for himself at his own birth. All of these disappointments made him fear what it would mean if he also lost his one last way of feeling powerful and successful, by being a top athlete. When boys feel the pressure to do well at sports, they are capable not only of hiding injury the way Peter did, but also of actually harming their bodies. Brian's story, which follows, suggests some of the problems boys can carry into early manhood, when sports become all about succeeding, when sports stop being play. Despite positive success in wrestling, Brian came away so compulsive about succeeding as a wrestler, he no longer knew when and how much to eat. Brian, obsessed with his weight. It was not until he was a college sophomore watching a made-for-television movie about a woman with an eating disorder that Brian recognized some of his own behavior. Brian had found himself on a continual eating binge since he finished high school. He hadn't thought of himself as having a problem because hadn't he always been able to take off weight when he needed to? And, he asked himself, wasn't it just girls who starved themselves who had a problem? In fact, Brian had been quite successful as a high school wrestler. He didn't have the size for football or the hand-eye coordination to make the baseball team, but he liked the intellectual puzzles and the disciplined, strategic one-on-one competition of wrestling. Brian's coach gave him a consistent message. Stick with the daily workouts, learn the right moves, cut weight, and you will win your matches. The hardest part at first was cutting weight. In the peak of his growing years, Brian had to lose almost 20 pounds to compete in the ideal division for his height. He had then regained and relost the same 10 pounds a dozen times each wrestling season. "I used to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in 50 bites, just to make the feeling of eating last as long as I could," Brian told me. "I drank gallons of water a day. Then, the day of a match, I'd go into the whirlpool bath for an hour to sweat the water out. I'd do anything to have a chance at winning in the one sport I could succeed in. Guys who weren't athletes were nerds. They got left out of everything. They hardly had friends, let alone girlfriends. I couldn't let that happen to me." After 4 wrestling seasons, Brian left for college and quit the sport. "I decided I couldn't spare the time from my studies, and at first I was relieved that I didn't have to go around thinking about how long I was going to have to stay in the whirlpool bath if I had a donut instead of a diet soda. But now I realize I've gone the other way. I went from being anorexic to serious problems with binge eating. Because of the craziness of wrestling, to this day I can't stop gorging myself," Brian told me. "I'm afraid I'll never be able to eat normally again, and I'll get huge." While Brian's story may seem unusual, statistics suggest that dozens of wrestlers of high school age injure themselves every year by either binging or stopping to eat normally. Because wrestling requires boys to compete against other boys in the same height and weight class, one of the strategies coaches use to win is to make smaller boys beef up by eating a lot and lifting weights, so that they'll be stronger, and make the bigger guys lose weight by going on crash diets, doing aerobic exercise, and purging water through saunas and steam baths, so that they'll end up wrestling against smaller, weaker boys. Some of the boys suffer only minor health problems, while others actually become bulimic or anorexic. Even worse, it was recently publicized that in the United States, each year, as many as 3 high school-age wrestlers actually die because of eating disorders. Apparently, an intense desire to do well and to be praised for their success as athletes lends many boys to become so obsessive that they actually do harm to themselves. Finally, in an emerging new era of research, much of which is being conducted by Dr. Harrison Pope and Roberto Olivardia, my colleagues at Harvard Medical School, there is growing evidence that many men, and thus probably many boys too, are becoming increasingly obsessed with their bodies, so concerned about whether they are large and muscular enough that they become exceedingly compulsive about weightlifting, dieting, and similar activities. But what is perhaps more common is for boys simply to overdo it when it comes to playing sports. 16-year-old Scott reported that when he finally found a sport he was good at, running track, he felt he had to do just about whatever it took to succeed. "Most days I get up between 4:30 and 5 in the morning to go running. I usually do about 5 miles and then head home. During the track season, after doing sprints with the team, I run about 10 to 12 miles. Off-season, I go home each afternoon, get changed, and run around 10 miles. On the weekends, I go running about 10 to 15 miles a day. I've always wanted to be good at a sport. Now that I've got one I can do well at, I'm going to keep on going. Maybe even try for the Boston Marathon." 17-year-old Adam, who competed in boxing and wrestling, and who had a black belt in karate, shared the following. "I pretty much eat, drink, and sleep with wrestling, and sometimes karate. During the wrestling season, I'm really busy at practice and doing meets, but all year round I lift weights about 3 hours a day. I also watch professional wrestling as much as I can. My mother's always telling me to turn off the TV. She hates wrestling." On the surface, These may seem to be boys who have simply become very involved with a sport. The fact that they feel devoted to a particular sport in and of itself may be something to be encouraged, since it suggests they are motivated, hard-working, and destined for success. But I believe it's important for those of us who mentor and coach boys to be vigilant about distinguishing between a boy's healthy devotion to learning a sport and an all-consuming, self-destructive obsession, a loss of balance, and a lack of respect for human limitations. Ideally, playing a sport should enable a boy to develop new skills and build his self-confidence as he hones them. But when playing that sport becomes the sole source of a child's self-esteem, to the point where the child is devoting all of his waking hours to training for and performing that sport, there is some risk that the boy will end up harming himself or others. He can hurt himself through bodily deprivation, for instance by not eating or by continuing to work out following an injury, through exhaustion, by exercising or practicing beyond his capabilities, or by setting himself up for severe emotional distress, for instance, by allowing a limitation in his game to become an intense source of self-hate. He can hurt others by going overboard in playing a game, pushing, checking, or tackling too hard, verbally attacking team members or opponents, by cussing at rivals or telling off team members when they make mistakes, or by actually injuring others, for instance by starting a fight during a hockey game, or by throwing a baseball at somebody with the intention of hitting him. These kinds of damaging behavior are rare when we teach boys that a game is a game, that sports are a kind of play. But when we allow them to think of sports as a vitally important measure of their self-worth, when they become too wrapped up in how well they perform a sport at any particular game on any particular day, boys can end up seriously injuring themselves or others. So much of what affects the sports experience for our sons is how we guide them through it and how well we supervise the other adults who do so. Sylvia, A Mother's Place. I met Sylvia Stanton in her second-story walk-up apartment in San Francisco. She was a diminutive woman, then in early middle age, with the look in her soft brown eyes of a person who has seen her share of heartbreak. We were surrounded by an elderly but affectionate poodle and beautiful parrots. "It's just the animals, Andrew and me now," she said, with just a hint of sadness in her voice, "since Jonathan died." Her husband, a popular schoolteacher, had a family history of heart disease, and despite all efforts and precautions, had died of a massive and sudden heart attack 3 years earlier, at age 49. That was when Andrew was only 12. But he had been bearing up well under the strain, Sylvia thought. Andrew was a scholar-athlete who played varsity soccer, tennis, and football on his middle school teams, and continued to letter in high school. We were focusing on an incident in a special football summer camp Andrew had attended only 2 months after his father's death. Andrew had wanted to have the opportunity to go to this camp, run by a series of well-known high school and college coaches, and his father had wanted him to go as well. Sylvia thought that it would be important not to let Jonathan's death deter Andrew from this goal, and agreed to drive him the 30 miles every day so that he could attend. As you might imagine, the workouts at the football camp were grueling, and each day after the last scrimmage, Andrew would look more and more like a limp dish rag, ready for supper and bed. "He never complained," she said. "It's just not his nature. Although that summer he clearly had diminished energy, what with the sadness we all were still feeling about his dad's untimely death." Then, one Friday afternoon, when Sylvia arrived to bring him home, Andrew was nowhere to be found. Sylvia finally traced him to the infirmary, where he was sitting curled into a little ball, holding ice to his leg and barely choking back tears. "Come on, Mom, let's get out of here," he sighed. It wasn't until near the end of the long ride home that Sylvia pieced together the entire story. Sylvia was incensed. It seemed that Mr. Biaggi, head coach at the camp, had been pushing Andrew quite hard. Andrew continued to do the prescribed push-ups, but he began to tear up and cry. He was still fragile from his father's death. At that point, Mr. Big, as the boys called him, started to taunt Andrew, calling him a girl, a pansy, who couldn't take it. "If you're going to be a little faggot, you can go sit on the bench," he apparently screamed in front of the other kids. Andrew refused to give in and continued the routine. But all of a sudden, he heard his ankle pop. He had sprained it the previous summer, and it seemed to be pulling out of the joint again. Andrew crimped his leg and fell to the ground. "Stanton, what the hell is stopping you?" Coach Biaggi blared. "I sprained my ankle, Coach. This time I just can't finish." "That's your choice, kid, but a man plays out the game. You can do five more. You can finish the last five push-ups, or get off the field and don't bother coming back." Andrew, who was not ordinarily easily intimidated, began to cry. He didn't want to be kicked out of practice, and so, despite the pain and resentment, he finished the push-ups and then reported immediately to the infirmary. By the time they got home, Andrew's foot was quite swollen. Sylvia took him to the pediatrician, who wrapped it and suggested that the boy skip camp for a couple of days. On the way home from the doctor's office, mother and son began to talk again. Andrew was as angry as his mother was, but he was worried about what his mom might do. Sylvia felt hurt by this, and was also pained to see Andrew injured and upset as well. She was confused about how to respond. She knew Andrew needed to navigate his own world by himself and fight his own battles. "I always tried to give him space, but this was different. It went beyond Andrew's personal struggle to the whole principle of how, in just a small way, do you change the world these kids have to grow up in. Andrew is a sensitive kid, still close to me. At home, he can still put his head on my shoulder, and we cry together about his dad. Okay, I know it's still different for boys in a public space, but no one should be allowed to treat someone like that without even knowing him." Sylvia and Andrew talked. Andrew was upset and angry at first, but then realized his mom was right. Something had to be done. Andrew reluctantly agreed to let his mother speak to the director of the camp. Sam Donatuck had spent many years coaching boys and young men in the sport he loved best, indeed loved more than anything else in the world, football. So Sylvia had a real task before her. But the meeting with Sam was strange. Neither the struggle she expected, nor the agency for change she had dared to imagine. The head coach didn't share Sylvia's sense of outrage or horror about what had been done to her son, but he immediately agreed that Coach Biaggi had gone overboard. Sam would talk with Coach Biaggi, and Andrew would never be treated that way again. "You've got to understand, Mrs. Stanton, that unlike your son, some boys do need a kick in the pants to get motivated. It's the nature of the business. We can't be letting them get too soft on us. We coaches are there to push them beyond what they thought they could do, and that's a lesson they can carry forward in life." Sylvia heard this, but said, "I don't agree, Sam. I believe strongly we can motivate our boys positively without harshness, without hurting their feelings or mistreating them. That was the day Sylvia Stanton joined the governing board of her local boys' football association, and her son Andrew began the certification process to become an assistant coach for the junior division. "You've got to start somewhere, and why not here?" Sylvia explained. In telling Sylvia's story, I mean to remind us of the power parents have to step in to make a difference in how boys experience sports. While some parents might not feel comfortable being as assertive as Sylvia was, I have found that most of us have the ability to participate in one way or another to coach our coaches. Some parents may do this just by showing up at a game and offering encouraging remarks from the sidelines. Some may do this by attending team practices and perhaps volunteering to assist in aspects of training or coaching the team. And some may do this by being advocates for caring, thoughtful coaches, for men and women who will make our sons feel like important members of the team, who will urge these boys on in positive, confidence-building ways, and who will help them learn to accept winning or losing as an inevitable part of life. Coaching the coaches. How parents can ensure that sports are transformative. Given the amazingly transformative experience that sports can be, I have found that it is critically important for parents to stay involved in their sons' athletic activities. All of the positive attributes of sports militate in favor of parents intervening to make sure that this philosophy remain in the forefront of boys' athletic activities. The overly competitive, brutal, obsessive aspects of sports, the aspects that lead boys to be injured both physically and emotionally, can be avoided if parents pay close attention to how their sons' activities are being directed. I have found that parents can intervene in all of the following ways. Participate directly in your son's sports activities. By doing so, you can help model the positive approach to sports discussed in this chapter. Whether you join in as a teammate, serve as a coach, or just cheer from the sidelines in an upbeat, non-shaming way, your direct participation can make a world of difference in setting the right tone and making sure your son's experience is a good one. Monitor your son's coaches. Even if you do not have the time or inclination to stay directly involved in your son's athletic activities, you can also help him by monitoring the coaches he plays under, what I call coaching the coaches. Just as no parent would tolerate a school teacher who was doing a poor job of teaching his or her children, no parent, I believe, should tolerate a coach who isn't doing an effective job at leading boys in their sports activities. Teach sports in the same way you would teach other areas of learning. Indeed, I believe that sports should be taught to boys with the same patience and thoughtfulness with which most other areas of learning are taught. And so, boys who make mistakes or have trouble learning when they're involved in certain sports should be treated no differently than students who struggle with mastering math, reading, or writing. Accordingly, if you are coaching boys in sports or coaching a coach, make sure every boy is given patient, appropriate feedback and has the chance to develop his skills at a comfortable pace. As you supervise boys playing sports, you may find it helpful to try to model yourself after a teacher you admired when you were growing up, somebody who was thoughtful and encouraging, someone who actually helped you learn and grow. Try to remember, for instance, the kind of teacher who assigned tasks that students could actually do reasonably well if they tried, who explained why an answer was wrong rather than berating the student who gave the incorrect response, and who helped each student, so long as that student was making a good-faith effort, to feel good about the academic progress he or she was making. Then imagine how different your experience would have been if that teacher was one who, instead, always taught students using problems that were far above their skill level, or who, every time a student offered an answer in class that was wrong, signaled that the student was a zero or a loser, or who told his or her students that if they couldn't get 100% on all their tests or couldn't achieve straight A's, they would be considered failures. Obviously, the first kind of teacher ends up helping a broad range of students, including those who are naturally bright, as well as those who struggle academically, those who feel secure as well as those who are less sure of themselves. The second kind, by contrast, assists only a small segment of students, either those who are already very knowledgeable or those with incredibly tough skins. Likewise, when you're teaching sports, or when you're advising somebody else who is, make sure they're set up so that boys at all skill levels can participate and master the game, so that boys receive plenty of encouragement, so that winning is not hailed as being everything. Remember that shaming, in word or deed, is never an acceptable coaching technique. Do all that you can to foster the transformative experience of sports. This means encouraging boys to be emotive, but cautioning them against being overly aggressive or hostile toward others. Supporting the close, affectionate relationships they develop with their teammates, but interrupting excessive teasing or taunting. Providing as much positive feedback as possible to help boost their feelings of confidence, but not pushing them to become obsessive about how strong or successful they are as athletes. And modeling a good attitude about losing, one that helps them in a positive way to learn from their weaknesses and failures. All of this can be achieved whether you do it by getting directly involved or by overseeing how your son is coached. Insist upon multi-tiered athletic programs that address boys' varying levels. Just as most schools assign students to various classes based on their relative scholastic abilities, athletic programs should ideally be structured so that they embrace all boys at all skill levels. For example, in an after-school soccer program, some coaches have found it helpful, rather than just having varsity and junior varsity teams, to set up 3, 4, or even 5 different teams. In some cases, these teams are divided by skill level, and in some cases, they are set up so that boys with top athletic skills are mixed in with boys with less advanced skills. Another approach is to create an intramural system where teams that are not ready to play against teams from other schools practice side by side with teams that are ready to take on such outside competition. Insist that your boys' school implement programs that are creative in providing such diverse opportunities for boys at all levels of athletic achievement. Encourage your boys' school to guyify. Just as during the 1960s and 1970s, schools began to give girls increased opportunities to play female versions of sports traditionally enjoyed exclusively by boys, such as baseball, basketball, and hockey, I believe the time has come for schools to broaden their perspective by guyifying aspects of sports typically thought of being appropriate only for girls. For example, some school systems have guyified cheerleading, so that boys who are less comfortable on the field and more comfortable encouraging their teammates from the sidelines can become cheerleaders without fear of ridicule and without feeling left out of the game. Encourage co-ed sports. In a similar vein, co-ed sports provide an excellent opportunity for many boys. This means not only allowing girls to play on boys' teams or to play sports typically thought of as being for boys only, but also allowing boys to play on the girls' teams and to play sports typically thought of as being for girls only. I know some schools, for instance, that now have co-ed field hockey, lacrosse, basketball, and volleyball. On the whole, co-ed sports tend to be set up in a way that allows for a greater level of participation and confidence building among kids of all different shapes, sizes, and abilities. Co-ed sports can be wonderfully transformational for boys and for girls, and should be vigorously encouraged. Use sports to teach boys to respect their bodies and learn respect for their limits. Finally, as we saw earlier in this chapter, some boys go too far in how they play and train for sports. Some extend themselves physically in excessive ways. Some become too aggressive or reckless in how they play a sport, injuring themselves or others. And some actually harm themselves by developing eating disorders such as bulimia and anorexia nervosa. Most often, there are always some boys who just seem to overdo it, pushing their bodies beyond their natural limits. While it's wonderful to encourage boys to be devoted to themselves and their teams, and to try to reach new levels of athletic performance, it's quite another thing to allow boys to hurt themselves or others. So don't stand on the sidelines. Get involved. Encourage your boys in a healthy way, and intervene if things go too far. As one boy, age 11, recently said, following his recovery from a serious track injury, "I've really learned that all you can do is your very best. As our coach always tells us, there is no finish line." The Greeks, who gave us the legacy of the Olympics, believed that all life must be seen in balance, and that even heroes, including sports heroes, must face tragedy and loss, along with the glory of victory. Sports, when genuinely appreciated under the tutelage of a wise mentor coach, can both uplift and humble boys, at once at the top of their game and almost simultaneously confronted with injury, loss, and defeat, turning real boys into strong, healthy, confident men. And he who in his youth secures a fine advantage gathers hope and flies on wings of manly action, disdaining cost. Men's happiness is early ripened fruit that falls to earth from shakings of adversity. Men are duty-bound. What is a man? Man is a shadow's dream. But when divine advantage comes, men gain a radiance and a richer life. Pindar, Odes. The radiance and the shadow's dream, both are parts of boys that sports may help to reveal and draw out. In the hands of the proper coach, sports provide a place where the rougher edges of boys' love may be softened and expressed freely. To keep sports in proper perspective and balance, boys need to cultivate the spirit of play so easily lost to the cult of victory or competition. Then and only then will sports fulfill its true mission, releasing boys from the restrictions of the old boy code and offering them genuine opportunities for personal transformation. Part 3. When the Bough Breaks. The toil of growing up, the ignominy of boyhood, the distress of boyhood changing into man, the unfinished man and his pain. William Butler Yeats, The Dialogue of Self and Soul. Robert. At the beginning of third grade, 8-year-old Robert started getting into trouble at school. He picked fights at recess, taunting other kids. In class, he seemed unable to concentrate. Full of restless energy, he couldn't sit still or stay quiet. He began to be known as a troublemaker, and his grades started to slip. Prior to this year, Robert had always been an easygoing boy who got good grades. If we analyze his behavior, we can detect several of the criteria from our diagnostic model. Acting out, excessive aggressiveness, problems with concentration, and academic difficulties. Robert, whose father was a prominent banker who had been convicted for fraud, had been traumatized by his father's abrupt departure from home. Now Robert was exhibiting symptoms that, in my opinion, constituted mild to moderate depression. Philip. 14-year-old Philip also showed dramatic behavior changes when he entered high school. He started hanging out with the tough kids and smoking pot. Soon he was staying up late at night and was unable to get up in the morning. He skipped school often and started failing courses. He and his mother started fighting constantly, and Philip would often shout at her loudly and inappropriately. Philip's behaviors also fall directly within our diagnostic model. His use of drugs, problem sleeping, truancy, difficulty at school, excessive anger, resisting authority. Through discussions with Philip, I learned that his parents had recently divorced, and that both he and his mother were having a difficult time coping with his father's absence and dealing with life in a new and quite tense mother-son household. I diagnosed Philip as moderate to seriously depressed. Peter. After Peter's best friend Brad died in a car accident, 16-year-old Peter suddenly quit the basketball team and shut himself up in his room every afternoon listening to loud music. He consistently refused to join the family for dinner, just saying sullenly, "I'm not hungry." He started having thoughts of suicide. Peter, by seeking to isolate himself, refusing to eat, and thinking about suicide, satisfied several of the diagnostic criteria for boyhood depression. In fact, he was in the midst of a major clinical depression. Often, as I consult with schools or talk to parents, I hear of boys like Robert, Philip, and Peter. It's hard to think of depression when you first observe these boys' problem behaviors. But armed with our list of diagnostic criteria, we can become more effective at knowing when the boy is actually depressed. Also, I find that if one has the chance to ask a few questions, it may turn out that the boy has suffered a recent unacknowledged difficulty that may have precipitated his symptoms. For instance, on further investigation, it was uncovered that in Robert's case, his father, a prominent banker in town, was indicted and sent to jail for fraud. Philip's marijuana smoking started as soon as his parents announced they were getting divorced. Peter lost his best friend in a fatal car accident when Brad and some other boys drove home from a party drunk. Underneath Robert's restlessness and aggression, Philip's marijuana habit, and Peter's sullen withdrawal are sad, scared, and lonely boys. Though each is at a different stage on the continuum of depression, each has emotional problems severe enough to affect not only his present ability to function, but also his future lot in life. These boys have suffered serious life crises, but not insurmountable ones. But what has made these boys unable to cope with their situations and caused them to sink into depression is that these boys, like most boys, do not know how to talk about their sadness or openly grieve over their losses, and are not receiving the personal or professional help they may need. Steve and Marijuana, when parents miss their cue. To prevent boys from being trapped in the self-destructive spiral of depression, it's important that parents and other concerned adults intervene early. One family I worked with missed several early chances to reach their son, Steve, and brought him to me when he was 16 years old because he was by then a chronic marijuana user and in trouble with the local police. At this point, unfortunately, hostility and drug-induced numbness were Steve's habitual ways of coping with the world. "Sure, I smoke pot every day," he told me, "sometimes once in the afternoon and once at night. What about it?" He also said he smoked 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a week. I asked him when he started smoking. "I don't know. Maybe 3 years ago for cigarettes? 2 years ago for pot? Whatever." After months of weekly meetings, he still doesn't see his addictions as a problem. But he has begun speaking more openly, and with less hostility, about why he smokes. "It doesn't matter what I do," Steve says. "I used to get along with my mom, but I don't anymore. She just complains all the time. All she ever says is, 'Comb your hair, and turn down your music, and study more, and clean your room.' The other day when my report card came, she said, 'I'm good for nothing like my father.' I hate her. My dad doesn't talk. He says like one word a year. My sister just talks on the phone all day and all night. I have guys I hang with in school, but I never see them outside of school." I asked Steve if his father really was good for nothing. "Yeah," he says. "He has this lousy job, so we can't buy anything, and he just watches TV every night. We'd be better off without him." "Is Steve like his father?" "I don't know," he says. "Maybe. But at least I talk once in a while." Steve is slow to acknowledge the cycle of disappointment and disconnection with his parents that has taken place over the years. But he did tell me about a formative event that happened when he was 11 years old, which clearly made an impression on him and set the stage for his hardened attitude toward his parents. "The day after school started, my dog got run over. He really was my dog, no matter what my sister says. My mom got him for me before she was even born. So anyway, my mother, sister, and I heard a car slam on its brakes, and we ran outside. My sister started crying. My mom was talking to the lady in the car who hit Sam. I walked away and nobody even noticed. I went and hid in this old junk car we have in the garage. I kept feeling this lump in my throat, but I didn't want to cry, so I swallowed the lump. That night, when my father came home from work, my mother told him about Sam. Dad yelled at me, 'I told you not to let him in the front yard,' which wasn't even true. I just walked away. I went to my room and didn't come out until the morning. I asked if anyone came in to talk to him. 'Nope,' said Steve. 'Nobody cared. They just had dinner without me.'" Steve's family wasn't there when he needed them. When he was sad about his dog so many years ago, he would have been greatly helped by a kind word or a sympathetic hug. Instead, he was yelled at, ignored, and shut out of the family. No one in his family even acknowledged his grief. At that point, Steve's sadness over his loss was compounded by sadness over the lack of caring from his family. In return, Steve began to shut them out and adopt a studiedly nonchalant attitude, a pose he has probably perfected in the 5 years since his dog died. Maintaining that tough attitude, completely covering up his grief and his longing for an emotional connection to his family, is a difficult act, one made immensely easier by the daily administering of emotion-deadening substances. But even if we didn't know the exact source of Steve's grief and disappointment, we could more easily determine that he's depressed by using our diagnostic criteria for boys. His persistent denial of pain, his withdrawal from his family, his problems at school, his low self-esteem, and his increased drug use all signal that Steve may be seriously depressed. The Lords of Destruction. Depression in boys can be fatal. In addition to suicide, many of its other symptoms, abuse of drugs or alcohol, increased aggressiveness, conduct disorders, can end up being lethal. Consider the true story of the so-called Lords of Destruction. In the summer of 1997, 9 boys, aged 15 and 16, living in rural upstate New York, got together and started calling themselves the Lords of Destruction. It seemed at first that this was just typical teenage boasting, because these boys were more aimless than dangerous. They were poor students, not very popular with girls, and unsure of their futures. Their backgrounds were similar, but not shocking. A history of learning disabilities and failure at school, combined with parents who didn't care enough or have time enough. The boys became known for skipping school, drinking beer, stealing small items from local merchants, throwing rocks at cars, and just being generally annoying small-town punks. One night, the boys drank too much. 4 of them got into a car, and driving 100 miles per hour in a 40-mile-per-hour zone, ended up running the car into a tree. They were killed instantly. Just a few months later, at a drunken sleepover, 2 other lords got into a fight. One brandished his grandfather's shotgun, which accidentally went off, killing the other. A 7th boy, depressed over his friend's deaths, was sent to a drug rehabilitation center. An 8th member of the group, after a petty theft, was sent to a juvenile detention facility. In the fall, there were 9 boys. By the spring, only 1 boy was still alive and living at home. In the words of one of their peers, these boys were just aiming to live fast and die young. I wonder what it might have taken to save these boys from dying quite so young. Part of the problem is that we explain away so much in our teenage boys as just the wilder side of boys will be boys. We respond as though boys were biologically driven by some sort of testosterone-inspired desire to drive too fast, to drink too much, and to play with guns, as though it were normal for boys to be so filled with so much despair that they don't care whether they live or die. Unfortunately, sometimes we see drugs and alcohol and our minds snap to a moral judgment. We blame our boys for having a weak will and tell them to just say no. We blame the addictive power of substances, the drug lords in Colombia, or the persuasive junkies in the next town. As long as we can find someone else to blame, we don't have to admit that perhaps, just perhaps, our boys are taking drugs because they're suffering intense emotional pain. But in the rush to judgment, we can again miss the chance to understand our boys and the compulsions that might drive them to drug use. These lords, these ordinary boys, satisfied many of the diagnostic criteria for depression we have proposed be used for boys. They were socially withdrawn, abused drugs, acted aggressively, suffered learning disorders, disrespected authority, performed poorly at school, and obviously had low self-esteem. In my opinion, each of them was significantly depressed. Suicide. Tragically, A disproportionate number of our boys are turning to the most desperate of solutions to depression and emotional pain, suicide. Since the 1950s, suicide rates for young white men have nearly tripled and remain twice as high as the suicide rate for all Americans. For African-American young men, the suicide rate has increased